When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Deeply Graphic Design Cast, the show about all things design, from the creative side to the business side and all points in between. Follow the show on Twitter at Wes McDowell. Want the gang to answer your question on an upcoming episode? Send in your listener question to questions@thedeependesign.com or via Twitter using hashtag DGDC. Here are your hosts.
Wes McDowell in Chicago.
Mikkel Morrison in Seattle.
Nick Longo in Los Angeles.
All right, all three of us are back, plus one, because Mikkel had a baby.
Aww.
How did it go? Easy birth,
it was
birth.
A total bitch and absolutely amazing.
Just the way God intended it, right? Did you do the drugs?
No.
Are you kidding?
Oh, my wow. God, what a trooper.
I know. I just needed Jason trooper. To be able to call me an effing warrior, and now I'm content.
There you go. Oh, you need a t-shirt with that.
I will refer to you as Xena Warrior Princess for the rest of the episode.
Yes, correct.
We were amazing. Actually, I think we were at 8 centimeters, and when you're there, you can't. It's not an option anyways.
So you just wait.
It's one of those things.
So I just went with the Ring of Fire,
good
man.
Good Lord, the Ring of Fire. A little Johnny Cash in the background. That's all you need.
Yeah. It was it was 12 hours, and we did half of the labor at home here, which was good.
Wow, okay.
Oh.
Close by.
Yeah, even Oakley was standing face-to-face in front of me and breathing, helping me breathe through contractions. Aww, it was the most adorable thing.
That's awesome. Wow.
I feel I would be scarred for life. I remember that video in middle school, The Miracle of Birth. I'm still scarred.
And nothing got graphic for Oakley. He just saw my face like get all crazy.
Okay. How is he liking having a little sister?
It's an adjustment because he's not the one and only, and we're not three amigos anymore. But he's handling it really well because we're having him own the role of.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's awesome! Big bro. Can't wait to see more pictures.
Yeah. I know. Hopefully he doesn't become a control freak now that we've given him we've kind of emphasized it's your baby too, you know, but it's going really well. Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Guys.
Congrats. Good. Awesome. To the new addition in the Morrison household. So good for you.
Thank you.
And before we get started here, do want to remind everybody, if you're a new listener, welcome. And if you're an old listener, welcome back. We're glad to have you. So the best thing you can do for the show is just go on iTunes or wherever you listen to this and leave a review, leave a star rating. That helps us reach new earballs all the time. So that's what we're looking for. And that's how you can help us the most. So we appreciate it greatly. So before we get to the meat and the potatoes of the show, we want to give a little love to our friends at Skillshare, right? Because Skillshare makes it very easy to learn all the new skills that we need as designers and creatives, especially when we're running our own businesses. You know, it's because when you do that, guess what? You're not just a designer. You are also a debt collector, which we'll get to later. You're also a, salesperson. You do all the things. And Skillshare has
social networking.
Right. They've got every base covered at Skillshare. If you don't know already, they're an online learning community for creators with more than 25,000 classes in design, business, and more. You'll discover countless ways to fuel that creativity, curiosity, and career, the big C's. So take classes in all those things, social media marketing, photography, illustration, web design, all that good stuff. Whether you're wanting to discover a new passion, start a side hustle, or gain new professional skills, they are there to keep you learning and thriving. So I went on and took a little look. You know how I like to pair courses with the episode? We found I found one called Pricing for Creatives. And then I found another one called The Freelancing Guide to Managing Your Finances. So, you know, and those are just some like...
I wouldn't even think that was there. And it's like so cool to hear that they're covering that,
Just to simplify things for you, Nick, anything you can think of, that wouldn't be there, it's going to be there. They've got a lot.
It's probably there.
5,000 classes. What do you want? So those are the ones that I think are going to go really well with this episode. So go there, check them out. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. You can learn so much in 2 months. And they're offering our listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 25,000 classes absolutely free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/deepend. Again, go to Skillshare.com/deepend to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/deepend. All right. So we have got an awesome show for you guys today. We had a few episodes back. We talked all about, you know, contracts and all that stuff and all the legalese kind of stuff with our guest Angie.
Yeah.
And since then, Steve Pomerantz has reached out and said, you know what, Wes, that was a great episode. I think I've got a little bit more to add to that, specifically as it comes down to, you know, enforcing payment contracts and that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
we have, please welcome CEO of Freelance Collection, Steve Pomerantz. Welcome, Steve.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Hey, welcome, Steve.
So yeah, thanks for reaching out. I think this is going to be a hell of an episode because we don't do this for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we do this for free, but we don't do that for free. So, so why don't you go ahead and just start by telling us about Freelance Collection, how you got started with it, why?
Sure. So my story, I guess, is intertwined with why I started Freelance Collection. So I started as a management consultant and did some film finance, escaped that, knew I wanted to start companies. So I sort of did a poor man's business school type thing. So I started working as a freelancer for startups, just sort of to learn the ropes. In the course of that, I had a couple clients who stiffed me. And we can go into those stories later. But so that happened. I went on to start another company called Tuition.io. We help employers pay down their employees' student loans as an employee benefit. And then years later, I was trying to figure out what to do next. And a good friend, his wife had just been stiffed on a web developing job, and he came to me with the idea for Freelance Collection. And it obviously resonated with me, and I had had the experience before. So it was sort of a vague idea at the time. It was, you know, there you could do some type of business. He proposed it as going to court for people who'd been stiffed. As I got further into it, I sort of figured out what the business should be. So what we do is, if you go and search for a collection agency for freelancers or a lawyer for freelancers, you're not going to find much. You're going to find a bunch of collection agencies and lawyers whose websites look like they're, you know, a lawyer's website from 2003. You're not going to be able to figure out who does a good job at what they do, and who does it well, who does it ethically. So over time, over trial and error, we've vetted a lot of different collection agencies and lawyers, and we've also found out that the better ones don't even want to work with individual freelancers or one-offs. They want big bulk clients. So we started aggregating freelancers and small businesses, and so they view us as a big client. So we're able to get you into the very best providers and get treated like a big client.
That's cool, because
That's like such a missing link, man. That's great.
That's the big thing I would think as a freelancer, the barrier to entry. It seems like you'd almost just think, ah, screw it, it's gone. Yeah. I can't fight another company, nor do I want to. But if you can pair up people with lawyers and attorneys that are willing to take on smaller clients, that's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the time, screw it is the right answer. And we can certainly, we're going to get to all this, but one of the big things I tell people is your time is so valuable, your sanity is so valuable. So that's always a part of the calculus.
For sure. All right. So Steve, why don't we get into just by, how can people, because the best thing is obviously just to not get in this situation in the first place. So how can a freelance designer avoid that non-payment happening at all?
Yeah. And before answering this question, I will say that when you Google, I've been stiffed, what do I do? 90% of the answers out there.
I don't know that I want to do that, Google.
Don't do that, Google.
I know.
Okay, so, wow, phrasing. I have not been paid for freelancing work.
Yeah.
90% of the answers that you'll find are, well, you should have done this. And so there's, you know,
true.
I'm going to give you the answer to your question, but I also think it's important that the Monday morning quarterback answer can be frustrating. So keep in mind that we're also going to give you in this podcast strategies for what to actually do when you get stiff.
Yeah, so, I totally want to play that clip of Adam Sandler, like, once again, things that could have been brought at my attention yesterday.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay, so there are a few things that you want to do, and they're all kind of common sense to make sure that you don't run into this problem. The most important thing is just trusting your gut. Most of the probably half the cases that come to us, people tell us that they had the heebie-jeebies about a client before taking them on, but they did it anyway against their better judgment.
As hindsight, do you mean? Or do you mean that they share that with you before they even know?
Oh, no. They'll come to us having not been paid. And they'll say, I knew it when I first encountered this person. They weren't, you know, they weren't giving me straight answers to my questions. They didn't want to.
Yeah. And you justify it.
If something was
there. If you
there.
Want the work. Yeah. I talked about this on the podcast all the time, and I still am guilty of it from time to time. You know, it's like
100%.
Sometimes you just want the work, or you want to be a people pleaser almost. And you always get those signs.
Definitely.
Absolutely. And so there's a Maya Angelou quote that I love. That's, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. It's my favorite quote. Mm-hmm. You should absolutely always use that in business because it applies so often. But beyond just trusting your gut, you want to follow the Google rule. You want to Google people before you do business with them. You can learn a whole lot with just a simple Google search. Go look them up on LinkedIn. A lot of the time, you'll find red flags. Well, not a lot of the time, but a lot of the time for the cases that come to us, people would have found red flags.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then there are a few just kind of rules of thumb that you should abide by. You always want to work with a contract. You always want to get paid something up front. 50% has kind of become standard. And you guys could probably speak to that. I mean, what...
That's what we preach pretty much on the show.
Yeah.
I think the two of you do 50% too, right? Or am I wrong?
I'm either 30 or 50. It's depending on size of the scope of services.
I always do 50 now.
I think I'm changing to 50.
I think you should. But Steve, can I rewind for a second, Steve, and ask you? You said certain red flags you'll find when you Google people. Like, do you have any examples of things people may find?
Sure. So we see everything from, we see, if you Google the person, you'll find, like rip-off report websites that have commentary about them. You might find on Glassdoor, which is a website where people review employers. You'll see that previous people who've worked there either worked at the company full-time or have been freelancers. They'll say, they'll say things didn't happen the way they should have. And maybe you'll find out that they've been named in a lawsuit, or that they've got a whole bunch of outstanding liens against their property or something like that. You never know what you're going to find, but worst case scenario, you're going to learn something that'll help you communicate with them better, and you'll understand what they do, who they are.
True.
Yeah.
I mean, you should Google them anyway, even just for that purpose, and then
especially if you don't know them and it didn't come through like a referral or anything like that. Smart way to kind of think about what could be possibly out there with them,
Even if they do come through a referral, we have a lot of customers who don't have contracts because they feel like something came through a referral.
Yeah.
And for that reason, they're like, oh, well, I can trust this person.
It feels like an automatic trust. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And one of the latest clients I had, I told the story, where it just went really terribly, really quick, was a referral. I've found since, like, this is not going to apply to most people, but like, since I've started my YouTube channel and I get most of my clients through that now, I find the referrals are almost my worst clients because they're not already on board with what I'm teaching on YouTube. So it's like those people all hire me because they like that aspect of what I'm teaching already. So I get new people, and now now I get people that are just looking for a quote website, which is what I, it's a sidebar, but yeah, referrals aren't always the best, just saying.
Right. So once you do those kind of check for red flags, basic rules of thumb of having a contract and charging some money up front, when somebody starts to go overdue, when you have an invoice overdue, you want to be super proactive. And obviously start by just being very informal about it and very polite about it. And hey, saw you missed this payment. Let's just make it right before things go stale, or before, you know, before we start to get more overdue. Your contract probably should have some language about interest accumulating. So you can be like, I don't want you to have to pay interest. Mm-hmm. That's not why I put that in there. I just, you know, I really want to work with you in, you know, have a good working relationship with you. So let's just get it squared away. But if you don't, you know, if that starts to fall on deaf ears, and if you don't start to get a good response when somebody goes over, when an invoice goes overdue, get on the phone or show up in person. Most people don't want to be confrontational. It's a lot easier to send an email, but the phone is a great tool, and it really is night and day.
Well, you get an immediate, you get like an immediate answer, because I've always noticed too with the texting or email or any kind of electric conversation, it could be in their hand, but they don't have to respond. But if you have them on the phone, you've got them. And hopefully, you know, as much as we don't talk on the phone too at all, at least it's very usable for that situation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. As uncomfortable as you are with confrontation, so are they. So.
Oh, yeah.
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 Good way to look at it.
'Cause they're getting a call basically from a debt collector at that point, which in my younger days, I've been on this other side of that call before, like, you know, so it's a very uncomfortable situation for sure. Do you have any kind of tips on how to, maybe a nice way to have that conversation start on the phone?
Yeah. I mean, you can say first, you can, if there's another work reason, you can have the conversation about that other work thing to discuss, and then drop it in. Oh, by the way, this invoice is overdue. Just wanted to make sure that you know that's going on. Are you working to get that paid? Or when can I, you know, just wanted to confirm that I can expect that payment's on its way. And you know, most of us, if we were on their end of that call, we'd say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You'll be paid later today. If that's not their reaction, that's your first reason to be suspicious.
And I always, whenever it's a time for a new payment, like after the deposit and I've got a progress payment, I always tell them, like on our weekly call, I say, okay, so what's going to happen now in order for us to continue, you know, I'm going to send this invoice and that has to be paid before we can continue. So I make it very clear that I'm putting my pencil down right now until that goes through, just so they don't think that I can pay it when I get to it. I make sure they're aware of that.
Right.
I find that
it's not business as usual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always give that advice that I sort of was saving for what I know we're going to get to next, which
I stepped on it.
Well, no, you didn't. I mean, it sort of blends together because this process, unfortunately, sort of leads into what you need to do when you realize that somebody doesn't immediately say, oh, let me get you paid.
Right. Is there anything else you want to get to for the upfront stuff? Like the, how to avoid it before we get into the cleanup aspect?
Those are
the steps. Yeah.
Those are the main points. What I will say on having a contract, Angie, a few weeks ago, Angie's a lawyer. I should also say, by the way, I'm not a lawyer. Nothing that I say here should be construed as legal advice.
Yes.
The lawyer's answer is always going to be, you should have a lawyer draw up a contract for you, and you should. But sometimes, especially if you're like a freelancer just starting out and you're going to have your first client, it might not be feasible to pay a lawyer to sit with you for hours, understand your business. Lawyers are expensive. That being said, always better to have something done custom by a good lawyer who knows what they're doing. But there are other good resources out there, and if you Google contract template for freelancers, you're going to find some really good free resources.
What about like LegalZoom? Do they do anything that's kind of halfway between the free thing and something really custom?
They do. I'm not super familiar with their offering. I know that they don't have like, I'm pretty sure they don't have a free template out there for this.
Yeah, I used them. I used them once where they do pair you up with someone based on what you need. And it's kind of spare time that I think what they do is they get kind of very reputable. I had a really great partner on that. And they linked me with someone based on an hourly that was good with me. But I think it was spare time for these guys. So they could fill in their hours by helping at a reduced rate. So it was very helpful for me because it wasn't super expensive. But it was really cool to have a trusting person on the other end. Yeah. So I highly recommend
it. And that's a free read from Nick for LegalZoom. So reach out, LegalZoom. Yeah. We're looking for a sponsor.
Come on, baby.
We don't have to stay on contracts forever, but there are a few clauses that you probably ought to have in your contract as a freelancer. You're going to want, and I think Angie mentioned this, venue is super important. So something we see all the time is we've got a freelancer who lives somewhere, maybe not even in the U.S. Their client is somewhere else that they just, it's totally impractical for them to go and show up in court. If you want to have the ability to use small claims court, which we'll get into later, it's super important that in your contract, there's in every contract, there's a place that says, you know, conflicts will be resolved in such and such a state, such and such a jurisdiction. I think if you're going to press for something, that's a really important point to press on, that it's in your jurisdiction.
I think in both cases that I had that I could have done something, that was the one thing I didn't have in my contract that would have been completely helpful because it was out of state. And I couldn't prove they did business here in LA or California. So again, that was a good lesson to learn. I'm glad you brought that one up because it's true. I think it's
and you're just really in trouble if they're out of country.
Yeah. Oh God, yeah. I mean, I think I just stopped with that because that was three situations. One was out of country, one was out of the state, and the third was bankruptcy. Yeah. So like
I'm so sorry.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
there's nothing like a perfect storm.
The trifecta. No, I'm just going to sign it. Right? Bye-bye.
Yeah, like I...
Awesome. Well, that was good.
I just don't work with other countries anymore for that reason, because if I don't want to take on a client that I can't feasibly enforce a contract if it came to it. Because I think they probably know that, too. That's the thing. So,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, a lot of the people we deal with really know that. Like, a lot of the debtors we see are serial debtors and they've done this before. They know the drill.
Any other clauses that we should definitely have in our contracts before we move on?
Certainly you want to have something in there that says if you ever need to use a lawyer or a collection agency that your client foots the bill for that. That way you don't have to pay our fee out of what you earned. You want to have interest if their invoice goes overdue. This would be a bonus that this is not standard, but boy, would it be good in all of the cases that we have if there was a personal guarantee. So if you're dealing with a client that's a corporation, and this would make sense if you're dealing with like a startup as your client, or someone that doesn't have a track record, you could say, and by the way, a personal guarantee means if there is ever a dispute, that not only can you go after them, after the company, but you can go after the person, the founder of the company, or whoever you're dealing with.
Ah, okay.
And so, of course, in their shoes, you would be super reticent to accept that term. But if you're providing a service to a startup or someone, you know, without a great track record, you could make the case that, you could say, I've heard that, you know, startups are, or I've had bad experience with startups as clients, and for that reason, this is my policy. But you might also not choose to go down that path.
Again, if there's something that tells you to, you might as well put it in there, because that's I think a lot of these little clauses give you a way to monitor how a potential client's going to react to them.
Yeah, that's also true.
Totally. You know what I mean? And if they're slam dunk, great, never had an issue, they're going to say yes to all these things because they need the work.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I haven't had too many pushback. I think earlier in my career, I had a lot more pushback on clauses and terms. I haven't really gotten that in a while. I've gotten no revisions asked for in a while.
Hopefully you didn't speak to
And that's completely consistent.
Your confidence, I think it has to do with a lot with your confidence in doing it a few times and feeling comfortable with it.
Yes.
Because those first few times I put it out there, I was like so hesitant to even talk about it. Now I'm like,
me too.
It's the first thing we talk about. I'm like, you don't, nothing happens. So if your whole persona on it is totally different in your approach to it, I feel like the confidence level is why you're not getting the pushback.
Yeah. I just give them the agreement online. Like, I don't even, I kind of don't even remember what's in it for me to feel bad. Like, once you do it enough times, you just kind of give it and you don't apologize for it. It's like the money conversation. I never, I never think.
Putting it into practice more and more is the fix.
Never occurs to me anymore to feel weird about asking for money. Like, as soon as that meeting's over, I'm like, all right, I'm sending you an invoice and the agreement. And once they're taken care of, we can go.
Here's what you can expect from me. Yep.
Yeah. I know we want to get into the next one, but Steve, one quick question. Do you suggest that we talk more about this with the client rather than just hope they're, even if they sign it and whatever, 90% of the time, are they really going through it? Is it smart to maybe take a few key goals of your contract and talk to the, talk to them verbally about it?
I think that's a stylistic, a personal stylistic choice. You know, I could see arguing for both sides of that.
I know.
Most clients won't bat an eyelash. Some might. So maybe you want to proactively head it off, but you also might just want to avoid an uncomfortable conversation because most people will just sign the contract you put in front of them.
Yeah, you're right. But I know, but I love to have that conversation now because after being burned big time a few times and I really always say it was my fault. I should have been more everything we're saying right now. So
maybe stylistically based on that learning, it's just one of those things that you constantly bring up and that's totally legitimate to me, Nick.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah.
If you're gonna avoid a landmine with go for it.
Yeah.
Totally. I know that there's so many angles that we can cut with this topic altogether. I just wanted to share one generic situation that I'm going through right now. Before we hit that the second discussion point, sometimes it's not about the client paying you. You're caught in the middle between vendor and client. So I have a situation where the client has informed. We've gone through a lot of internal organizational changes. A lot going on. In fact, my point of contact has shifted 4 times since the kickoff in November. I had 50% down. But because of the number of revisions following pre-press production, I've had to inform, like, you need to expect the rate's gone up, but we've gone through too many revisions at this point. And not only that, but you can expect a higher invoice from the vendor as well. Well, now that they're wanting to hold the project and complete it next month, which is a big fat joke, by the way, they're just telling me that.
Oh.
They refuse to pay the vendor. So it's put me in a very awkward position with the vendor.
So you're a subcontractor.
I've been in court. So I guess technically that is the case.
So did you have to put money up for it, or you just have a relationship with that vendor that you're now?
Yeah.
I have a relationship with the vendor that has been sending me samples, that's been sending me revisions, you know, and not only to my business address, but the clients to keep them informed on physically how the product is looking. And the client is now becoming a total bitch and is saying, I don't recall us signing any contractual terms that obligate us to contributing money to the vendor at all right now. And, you know, for me, I don't do an upcharge. I just supply what the vendor as an expense in addition to my invoicing. Here's the total based on the subtotal.
And that's exactly why I would. That's why
and
I
they're
would
refusing.
Because you're taking on that risk. That's why I would.
But they're refusing to pay the vendor altogether.
No, I know, but,
they won't pay
that's
any
why
vendor fees outside of MPM design.
But that's why I do
design.
An upcharge to kind of. Fact is, you're taking money. Mm-hmm. You're being paid extra because you're taking on that risk.
But I have to supply documented expense of the vendor alongside included to my invoicing. When do you not that?
But then you've your project management fee goes on top of that.
No, I take pride in not upcharging. People love this about our business. I refuse to do that.
Well, maybe what if you added the clause in the original contract that says if there are any exponential expenses outside anything we've talked about, including stock photography, fonts, outsourcing
vendor expenses.
Vendor expenses. That's one that will be included, and I will show you that's what I've done, because I think what I got a little burned on was stock photography or printing. Sometimes a client thinks that's included, so I've just made a note of those things that I always know they don't think they have to pay for, and make sure it's in there.
Yeah,
because then if it's a change
of
guard,
even read that. Those terms, by the way.
But you could show that contract whoever signed
now.
It three contacts ago, and you can say, hey, Bob from last year signed this on behalf of your company. So guess what?
Yeah.
It's part of it.
But this CEO, she's such a hardball player. I know she would come back with, okay, those might be your terms, but those aren't the vendor's terms. She's so like that.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, that's why I get...
But the only reason I wanted to contribute this story is because it's not necessarily always, this isn't necessarily always the case with non-paying clients directly. It can happen with these middleman circumstances that get a little bit convoluted, to be honest. I mean, it gets a little sticky. Yeah.
There are all sorts of different flavors of non-paying clients. And we even have a guide that we'll put out for all your listeners that refers to 20 different types that we've developed individual strategies for dealing with. Like your case it's definitely one that we've come across. And we see most of the companies we deal with are smaller, but we do see a lot of larger companies that you would think have their stuff together, that have all kinds of organizational, just logistical failings in how their departments communicate. And you know, you get handed off from one person to another. So, I mean, in your case, well, I would want to get into that contract and see what your original contract said. You know, it's true that you want to update your contract that you use in the future for this. And your contract should, by the way, be an evolving document that you, as you run into stuff, You fix it so that in the future you don't run into those things. But where you are right now, I think it comes down to what's in your original contract. At least you can go back and say, no, here, you agreed to pay the vendor expenses.
But yeah, but let's move on to this next topic, because I know we're all curious about this in way of steps you can take to actually collect payment altogether.
Yeah, so once you get to the point where you realize that there's something fishy going on, and that can look a lot of different ways. It might be that your client ghosts you. It might be that your client says they're not going to pay you because they don't like the work you did. It might be because your client says they ran out of money. There are a whole lot of different reasons, but once your spidey sense comes up, the first thing you should do before you engage your client is to check in with yourself and make sure that you remind yourself that it's not your fault. And this isn't just for touchy-feely reasons that I'm saying this, but you want to make sure that you're in a good headspace before you start engaging your client. Because, you know, you get more honey. What's the – oh, God.
More flies with honey.
You get more flies with honey. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you go in there guns blazing and are like, you got to pay me or else – you're much less likely to get a positive result in the interaction with your client.
Yeah, the threat.
Where's my money?
That's so true.
So that's a really key first step. But once you've done that, you want to, and we already sort of started to talk about this, you want to put your client on notice and say, all right, look, just, and start to have a paper trail or an email trail or something. But put your client on notice and say, hey, it's time to pay. You know, if the project is still ongoing, you say, I'm going to have to stop work until you pay me. If the project isn't ongoing, you still say it's time to pay. I don't want to have to escalate the situation, but we will, if nothing changes here. And you can also, you can appeal to your client, depending on your relationship with the client and whether you think they'd be receptive to it. You might want to appeal to their sense of fairness or their sense of doing the right thing. You could say, look, I need, you promised me you were going to pay me. I need it to pay my rent or to pay my employees or whatever. There are a lot of different ways you can communicate, but the important thing is to communicate and to both have a paper trail and to pick up the phone and to confront them in person like we talked about before. Now, there's another step, and I wouldn't necessarily encourage everybody to do this, but some people that I've that have come to us have done this in prior cases, and it's been successful. Some people do sit-ins on their clients. They will go to the office and sit there and wait for the person. This works really well when they're ghosting you. Not everyone has time to do it, and 99% of people wouldn't do it.
Unless I get anybody. I don't think I would ever have done
it. It's very uncomfortable, but maybe satisfying.
But part of me is thinking. Damn,
use your judgment. If you think if you think your client is going to be physically combative, don't do it. If you you know, if you think you might get arrested, don't do it. But the people who have done it, they're my heroes. It's like, I love these stories.
I want to hear some stories about those people. If you're one of those people, call into the show. We want to know your story and how it went.
Seriously.
So once you've communicated that it's time to pay and they're still not being receptive, then you can start thinking about going up the chain. You can go to a person's boss, to their partner, to their employees, to their investors, to their vendors, and give them fair warning before you do. Tell them, hey, you know, this isn't happening.
I have to take this up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to take this up a level.
You have to take it up a level. Yeah. And then once you've given them fair warning, take it up a level. Then if that still doesn't work, you're kind of, you're at a checkpoint, right? You got to decide whether it's worth, whether it's worth a real fight, because the options that you have from here on out are more official. So you can go the do-it-yourself route, which is small claims court, which is both great and not great. It's going to take your time. It's going to take a little bit of money to file, but to file the suit. But most states, small claims court, it's going to cost you less than $100 to file. The way you initiate that is by sending a demand letter, which is pretty much the same thing that you've been sending in your emails, but in a more formal way, and you should send it both by email and by snail mail with a return receipt. So you have the evidence that they actually received it. And we have a template up, a free template up for that on our website at freelancecollection.com. You can find a million templates out there for it online. So that's the first step in that process. Now, with small claims court, the good thing is you can do it all by yourself, assuming you're you either have the venue in your contract or you're close enough to your client to be able to avail yourself of small claims court. But you, when you win, you're going to get a piece of paper that says your client owes you the money. That doesn't mean your client necessarily is going to pay you the money. So then you have a whole other process, potentially, if your client doesn't pay up, to collect the money. So you could be looking at a long road. On the other hand...
So collections depends on getting a judgment from small claims court then?
Not all collections. This is just if you take the if you take the small claims court route. So other than small claims court, though, if you decide that either small claims court isn't for you or... you don't have the possibility of small claims court. And by the way, it's a really good decision usually to at least think about what your time is worth. If you want to make it a hobby to get this client to pay and make it about the principal, more power to you. But, you know, it's probably a healthier, a healthier decision most of the time to move on with your life and either write it off or let the professionals deal with it. So when you decide to let the professionals deal with it, you've got a choice.
That's a good point. We easily get so obsessed with this stuff. I mean, Then, because oftentimes it's about principle, like how dare they? There's this personal relationship, and it's like, I'm going to get them back. I'm going to get them back. And there's this power play at hand rather
than. It becomes
than
drama.
Just obtaining. It becomes
drama. It's incredibly personal. I get that.
Yeah.
But you've got to take a step back and say, does this really make sense? You know, my time is worth X. It's going to take me so long to chase this down. But for some people, small claims court is the right path. But it's just important to check in with yourself and figure that out before you make that decision.
Yeah. Good point. Really good point.
Yeah.
It's easy to get lost in this.
Do you find the demand letter has some success at that point? Because you know what I mean? I'm curious on that because I've used it before and it was the first, I think it was like the first step you take, like you said. But the one time I did use it just from me, got nothing. But then when I used it through the lawyer I was using through LegalZoom and it was on their letterhead, whole other experience.
And that's about right. Demand letter on its own usually won't do anything. Every now and then it will. But what does do something, sometimes it's the lawyer's legal head. Sometimes it's just having something that is a little scarier than just you as a freelancer or as a small business. Yeah. But a lot of the time it's, you know, filing a lawsuit, even if it's in small claims court, that's a whole other level. And then it becomes a lot more real to the person.
Okay.
So that can be very effective. Everything beyond what you do on your own is more effective. You know, all these steps that we're talking about, they're worth doing. We wouldn't bother sending the demand letter if it never was effective.
Mm-hmm. I think I've done one and I don't remember who, but I think I've sent a demand letter like within the past year and I don't remember the circumstances, but I think I got paid.
You sent it to me when I think you I owed you like $5 or something.
Pay up. You deadbeat.
Yeah. I bought you that coffee at Adobe Max.
I still have not been reimbursed. But Steve, I'm going to derail this for a second and ask a different question. Is there ever a circumstance where you recommend just kind of negotiating with saying basically when you're still in that talking phase, say, how about this? What if you paid me half of what you owe me and we call it a day? Do you ever recommend that?
Yes. Thank you. I sped past that in my steps, but that's definitely a step you should look at. So when you think your client will be receptive to negotiating, it's usually a good job to negotiate because you're going to save yourself time. And, you know, this makes sense when your client says they don't want to pay because they're not happy with the work. Or because something went wrong, you know, they can't use the work or something where it's clear that you did the work and that they're not disputing that that you did it to their standards. It's if however you have a client who just starts ghosting you, you don't want to start negotiating against yourself.
Right.
No way.
If you have a client that says they can't afford to pay you, that's a really good time to negotiate and do it quickly because you want to get paid before they run out of money. Can't get water from a stone. So
that number is just going to keep going down the more you wait.
Right. So in all of these, you know, in every one of these steps, you want to act quickly. That's always to your advantage. And in the collection industry, it's kind of the rule of thumb is that an overdue account receivable loses 15% of its value every month.
So, okay. Good to know.
So you want to stay.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got small claims.
Interesting side note there too. Interesting side note I was going to say, and this is going for California only because we just did this during tax time. You're only allowed $3,000 of unpaid client invoices to claim in your taxes.
Oh. Huh. I didn't know that.
Which was interesting because I went into it thinking I'm owed a hefty amount of money from 2018. And I'm thinking I went in there thinking, oh, at least I won't get taxed for it, whatever. You're only allowed to claim $3,000 max.
Okay. I didn't think California. You could do that at all.
Which I thought was...
I thought...
Well, because you were, you know, technically you weren't paid, so it's not income and it might be on your books.
Okay.
But think about it, you know, you... So I thought that was quite interesting that, you know, really at one point, and this was the first year it was like that. It had changed. It was much higher. I think it was 7,500 the year prior. So I just thought that was a little bit interesting. So all the more reason to make sure you don't let it get, like you were saying, Steve, to, you know, get it while it's hot. Yeah. Don't let it linger.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right. Sorry to break into the middle of the show here, but I got to give some quick love to our friends over at FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes ridiculously easy to use a cloud accounting software for agencies and freelancers alike. They're going to help you work smarter, get organized, and most importantly, with the theme of this here episode, get you paid quickly. FreshBooks has always been really great for designers. It's just a really intuitive interface. And the way they've got it built now, it's never been more friendly and more sexy to use, quite frankly. So with literally two clicks, you can set yourself up with FreshBooks online payments and end up with money in your pocket sooner. With most FreshBooks payments getting paid in one day, you can't lose. So you may not even need any of this collection stuff when you got FreshBooks on your side. So they've got everything. They've got multi-currency invoicing. They've got automated late payment reminders, which helps you avoid having that awkward talk with your clients about past due payments, because obviously that's a last-ditch effort to getting paid. You don't even want to have to go there. And with FreshBooks, you probably won't have to. And their support is amazing. We know that. They answer in three rings or less. So to claim your 30-day unrestricted free trial, go to freshbooks.com/deeplygraphic and enter Deeply Graphic Design in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Again, 30 free days, unrestricted free trial. Go to freshbooks.com/deeplygraphic and enter Deeply Graphic Design in the How Did You Hear About Us section. All right, now back to the show. So we've got negotiating. We've got small claims court. What's the next option after that? The big guns.
Yeah.
So then the big guns. Yeah, bring in the big guns. And you got to decide whether you want to go the legal route or what in the collections world is called the pre-legal route.
Or the mafia route.
Collection agency. Or the mafia route. And by the way, when I started,
we're not lawyers.
I can help you there.
When I started this company on the freelance collection site, I had some verbiage about what we do and what we don't do. And one of the things we don't do is I said we don't break kneecaps. And when I started getting into the collection industry, oh God, they hated that I even mentioned that.
Oh, I'm sure.
They were like, we're not going to do business with you if you have that on your website. So I changed the changed the copy.
That's one of those industries that doesn't have a lot of sense of humor about itself. I don't think so.
No, yeah, no, they do not. Well,
obviously,
you have to
not.
Think about it from their end. There's been so much bad press, and
a lot of broken,
so
a lot of broken shins
it,
too.
Yeah,
probably
a lot of broken shins. And a lot of people who just get relentless calls from debt collectors.
Yeah.
So this is all right. Here's another tangent that I'll try and do quickly, but. The debt collection world is broken up into commercial debt collection and consumer debt collection. Consumer debt collection is stuff related to your household, your family, or your, I'm trying to remember the exact way it's worded, but it's like student loans and medical loans and
credit cards
and personal loans, car loans, things like that, credit card debt. We don't touch any of that. And that's all where you see all the bad actors. That's where all the bad press has been, and it's much more highly regulated than the commercial side. Commercial is business-to-business debt collection, and that's where we specialize. So for the purposes of this conversation, we're talking about commercial debt collection.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
So the decision between a debt collector and a lawyer straight off the bat, lawyers can, very simplistically, the difference is lawyers can be more effective, but they're going to cost you some money. Most lawyers in the collection industry, by the way, you don't want to just call up your family lawyer friend who's a generalist. This is a really specialized field, and you don't want to bring a knife to a gunfight. You want to have somebody who really knows what they're doing. When you go to a commercial collections lawyer, most of the good ones will work on contingency, but you're going to have to front the amount that it costs to file the suit and to serve process. So to have a process server go out and serve papers to your debtor,
yeah,
the defendant.
And this sounds like it's for bigger money projects anyway, which maybe a lot of our listeners aren't really even at that level of, is it, I'm picturing like a lot of money involved at this point, right?
So not as huge as you might think. Okay. It can make sense to sue for as little as $3,000-$4,000.
Okay.
But if you're owed six figures or more than that, then maybe you want to consider paying an hourly fee instead of a contingency fee, which will run you, yeah, you know, 35%, somewhere in that range, yeah, or more.
And I don't think that's most of our listeners. At the six-figure mark, I doubt it, but there's a couple of you out there.
No,
and good for you.
Right. Yeah, if that's you, awesome.
Yeah exactly.
For the rest of us.
Why are you listening? No, I'm just kidding.
So the other option is starting with a collection agency. Now, they'll also charge a contingency rate. And it's going to be about the same, maybe a little bit less than you'd pay to a lawyer as a contingency fee, but a collection agency won't charge you anything off the top. Now, of course, a collection agency's toolkit is different than a lawyer's toolkit. A lawyer actually sues you in court. A collection agency gets you on the phone, tries to negotiate, tries to appeal to first your sense of fairness, and they start in a very sweet way. They say, hey, we're just calling to clear up this invoice so we can all move on with our lives. But if it becomes more adversarial, there are a few things that they can do. Some collection agencies will report to the credit bureaus, but really most of them will just tell you that they will sue. So it's sort of your way to be able to use the threat of a lawsuit without actually having to shell out potentially good money after bad to go file the suit. So for most cases that come into us, we first send them to collection agencies, but you know, we're not afraid to escalate to legal collections.
Yeah. Once you start playing the game, you can't be afraid to raise it up the ladder, right? Raise it up the flagpole. So,
although sometimes you are afraid, sometimes it's a bluff,
right?
You know,
it's all a lot of the time here, but
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, a lot of the time it's never going to make sense for you to sue, but hopefully your client doesn't know that. Maybe they do. So, you know, you're not always going to be successful, but it's worth a try.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do most people, once you get to maybe that level that a collection case is happening, do you find some people kind of just say, oh gosh, I best pay now.
Oh, like, yeah.
Does that happen?
I mean, that's why we do it. We are that scary voice on the other end of the phone that makes somebody realize that it's serious.
Sure.
Of course, it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a negotiation. So, you know, when we take on a customer, they pre-authorize us to settle to give a discount of up to 20% of the amount that's due, and to arrange payment terms of up to 12 months. But of course, that's not the first the first resort of the debt collector.
Right.
You know, fortunately, your interests and theirs are aligned. So they want to get as much money for you as they can. So you start by trying to get the full amount.
All right, cool.
Gotcha. All right, cool. All right, well, you've got a guide that goes over at least 20 different types of non-paying clients. Let's get into each and every one of them. No, I'm just kidding. Let's talk about your top three.
Yeah, yeah.
I can name about 40 of them, but I got one of them. And it's
And before you get going, Steve, why don't you go ahead and give our audience the URL to where they can get that guide for all 20 of these types, because I would definitely want to read through that.
Yeah, good spot.
Yeah, so the guide is called 20 Types of Non-Paying Clients and Strategies for Getting Paid. And if you go to freelancecollection.com/deeplydesign, you can download the guide for free.
Awesome. Thanks for providing that.
Perfect, man. Thanks for doing that. That's fantastic.
Cool. Sure. Very cool.
So talk about your top three. What are these types that we're
looking at? And my top three defined as my three favorite or my three most horrible or
whatever makes it most interesting.
How about the three most common?
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
So the most common one we see is the client who ghosts you.
Mm-hmm.
So often people come to us and they, you know, they did the work or they're halfway through doing the work and the client just goes radio silent. That's one of those cases where obviously a lot of the steps we talked about just don't work, because the steps we talked about involve communicating with your client. So this is a really important time to remember that you need to act quickly, because things become, because debts become harder to collect as time moves forward. So you want to tell your client, you want to communicate with them in every way you know. So email the email they're not the email address that they're not responding from. Make phone calls to the phone number that they're not picking up. Leave a message. You know, make sure that you communicate to them that you're about to escalate this, and it's better for both of you if you can get this settled without outside help, because going to outside help means you're going to have to pay a chunk of what you earned to a collection agent or to a lawyer. And it also means that your client is going to have some pretty unpleasant things to deal with. So it's in both your interest to settle up. So once, once you've done that and give them, you know, give them 3 days or so to respond, but not more, then it's time to go to bring in the big guns. There's really not much else you can do when someone ghosts you. It's a really, you tear your hair out because like, who would do that?
Yeah.
But cowards. This business has exposed me to the worst of humanity. So I no longer am surprised when I see people do it.
Yeah. Mm. A question on the ghoster, because I guess the ghoster kind of feels, let's say the ghoster is in the zone of, wasn't happy with the work or is paying you for, or, and ghosting you for that reason. Have you found in cases it's helpful to have snippet, keep all your email correspondence of times where everything was going great? Like I could look back at times and I had emails that were like, everything is fantastic. This is fantastic. Oh my God, everyone's loving this, whatever. And then when they ghosted me, it was because they didn't think it was good enough.
Yeah, 100%. You should.
So having that stuff
having
is valuable.
That is valuable. Any email trail is valuable. Yeah. And by the way, I forgot to mention this before when we were talking about contracts, but actually we can make this the next type of non-paying client.
Cool.
The client who claims no contract.
Okay.
So we see this one a lot too. It's especially common when you've found a client on Upwork or some other platform like that, which I'm sure you guys have opinions about whether you should find clients on Upwork to begin with. But a lot of the time we see people who have found a client on Upwork, then gone off the platform and started doing work for them off the platform, and they agreed with the client maybe over an email or a text exchange about the project, but they never had a formal contract.
Okay.
Oh,
we
gotcha.
See clients say, we never had a formal contract. I don't have to pay you. Well, that's not true. Again, I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice, but a contract doesn't have to be a formal contract that's signed to be a contract, to be a valid agreement. If you have in writing...
I mean,
the bare minimum that you should get in writing somehow is, I want you to perform this task for this amount of money or at this rate. And once you have that, we can take the case. So, right.
Wow.
So
good to know.
That's, you know, that's a reason to have that email chain.
Yeah.
But of course, if you can show that your client was continuing to give you more work and knew what the hourly rate was, if you can show that the client, that the client was happy with your work and then just disappeared on you. By the way, the assumption that you made that the ghosting client isn't happy with you, that's probably that's less than half of the ghosting clients of the ghosting situations we see. So much of the time it's the person doesn't have the money to pay or is just trying to dodge the bill.
Or I feel like this has happened to me before when they just lose interest in the project. Like they're kind of a more startup, more of an idea of a business. And then they have a whim that, I don't really want to start that business anymore. And they just move. Yeah.
Like a pre-startup.
Yeah.
I think that's a whole other category that exists now more than ever because everybody and their mom wants to start something. And we're typically kind of in the first phase of
they all want a logo,
they call
front
and
thing,
to.
And you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So that was your second.
And then the third, let's talk about people who actually don't have the money to pay or claim to not have the money to pay. That's a key distinction. First, when a client tells you, and this is probably not a big company, this is probably a startup or a pre-startup or some small company. Mm-hmm. When they tell you that they ran out of money or are running out of money, first you want to express your sympathy and tell them that, hey, that really sucks. I'm sorry that you're going through that. But quickly back that up with, However,
however,
this is my livelihood, and
I like where you're going, Steve.
when you hired me to do this, I didn't price in the risk that you might go out of business. So you know, you wanna be firm, and you wanna say, you know, it's your responsibility to pay me. Now, hopefully they respond positively to that. If they don't, that's a great time to start negotiating and say, all right, well, look, you're a little short on cash. How about you pay, you know, whatever percent of what, use your good sense to figure out what percent you ask for, but whatever percentage you owe me, you know, whatever you owe me, how about you pay me 75% this month, and or maybe you set up a payment plan, but be careful with the payment plan because they might be out of business by the time they have to pay the third installment. You want to try.
I like that 75-25.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Right.
Get the bulk of it.
If you can. I mean, get as much as soon as you can.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people with a client that claims they're going out of business, that's not an option. So then you kind of want to go into detective mode. You want to say, all right, if you're going out of business, have you filed the bankruptcy filing? And if so, you want to get your hands on that bankruptcy filing so you can make sure that it's authentic, make sure that it's the same entity that hired you to do the work. A lot of the customers that a lot of the serial deadbeats that we see they've got like 20 different LLCs set up.
Oh, and they can use the other
ones. So, you know, when you signed your contract, if you had a contract, make sure that it's the same entity and they're not trying to play some kind of shell game to just get you to go away and not have to pay you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you determine that, if they are legitimately going out of business, there may be a trustee who's, if there are assets, the trustee
handles it,
is going to divvy those up among the creditors. So you at least want to contact that person and make sure you get in line.
Yeah.
It probably isn't going to end well for you, but you might be able to get something out of that. And then the other thing is, it still might make sense for you to get in touch with a collection agency or a lawyer, especially if they don't have that bankruptcy filed yet. If they have the bankruptcy filed, not going to lie, your life is going to be a little tough with this.
Yeah.
The odds aren't in your favor. But if they haven't yet,
can vouch
hopefully
for that.
Hopefully you can at least get something worked out to get paid in like spare ergonomic chairs or something, whatever they got laying around the office.
Yeah, get that.
Harman, get something.
What is it? that one.
Yeah.
There you go.
I already got that.
Oh, very nice.
Ragger.
But that's we have no other way to in a situation like that where it is their entity and it's a bankruptcy, they're pretty much, there's nothing you can do, I guess, at that point, because they are more protected at that point based on going through it.
Unless you had that personal guarantee in your contract that we talked about before.
Now that's a great question. You can't, if you put that in your contract, that is, you could say, even with the exception, even in the event of bankruptcy.
This is precisely the scenario you do that for. You want to protect yourself in the event that you're doing work for some pre-startup that, you know, it's a dreamer, they've got a cool idea, but you're not sure how well capitalized they are, but they did form their legal entity.
Sure.
That's the perfect time to hold firm on that contract point.
Okay.
But it has to be in the contract. You have to say that specifically, even in the event of a bankruptcy.
Because the whole reason that you have an LLC or a corporation is to shield yourself, or a big part of the reason is to shield yourself personally from liabilities of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
the personal guarantee is a way to counteract that.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk more offline on this one.
All right, Steve. Well, thanks so much for coming on. This has been amazing.
For sure.
Throw it out again. Where can our audience get a hold of that guide?
Really useful.
Yeah, so the guide is at freelancecollection.com/deeplydesign. And you want me to, should I give where they can find me and all our stuff?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay,
sure.
So if you think you might want to bring in the big guns. I think we're the best option out there. We're at freelancecollection.com, and there's a form that you can fill out, and you'll get a free consultation, and we'll figure out if we're a fit or not. And we're on all the socials at Freelance Collection, except on Twitter. We're FL_collection because Twitter had a character limit.
Always.
I'm sure there's something else I'm forgetting, but that's all that comes to mind right now.
That's awesome. Well, thanks, Steve, so much for coming on.
Killer.
And we've never done this before, but we've actually gone pretty long today. So I'm thinking we're going to no listener question today, but we'll make up for that because our next episode is all listener questions. So if you want to throw one into the show for us to answer, go ahead and email that to questions@thedeependesign.com. And you know we love our audio questions, so go ahead and record yourself asking and send it on in, and we'll read it on the next, or we'll play it or read it if it's a text one on the next episode. So it's been a great episode. Thanks again, Steve, for coming on with us. And anything you guys want to plug or talk about? Well,
no, that was totally enlightening. I'm glad we talked about
that
it. Hopefully,
really,
and you're right. It was a great kind of companion episode to what we talked
about.
So
go forth and get paid.
That was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with that in mind, keep designing. Catch us next time on the Deeply Graphic Design Cast.